Hello, my name's Tom Boone.
And I'm Joanna Bailey.
Welcome to a brand new episode of the Simple Flying Podcast, where we'll give you the lowdown on the latest news from the world of commercial aviation. Here's what we have for you this week.
Coming up today, I'll take a look at a beluga's epic transatlantic journey, while Tom dives into his favourite airline's annual results.
Joe will look at the latest updates regarding the LATAM Dreamliner dive, while I look at some exciting news for Qatar Airways premium passengers.
Finally, I'll ask, how long is too long to be on a regional jet?
So now you know what's in store, let's get on with the show. And Joe, this beluga thing, I mean, you can't really tell me about it because I already know, but it's so exciting, so dive in.
It really is. It really is. And of course, we're not talking about the aquarian mammal. We're talking about the aviation beluga, which is Airbus's modified A300. So if you remember back, the US Department of Transport granted foreign air carriers permit to Airbus Beluga Transport in January. So Airbus Beluga Transport is like a separate company to Airbus. It is a subsidiary. It's obviously very much related to Airbus, but it's endeavouring to become its own airline and sort of do commercial transportation activities, and particularly into the USA. So it's been flying to the USA a little bit in the past, but as an Airbus aircraft, now it's flying as its very own entity, which is exciting. Airbus is going to be able to operate cargo charters to the US and is basically commercialising its fleet of A300-600STs. So these are actually being phased out from the manufacturer's in-house operations and are being replaced by the A330-700ST, which is also known as the Beluga XL. So it's those newer big birds that will be carrying around the plane parts to the factories. These older belugas, the original belugas, are going to be carrying commercial cargo. It hasn't really started its commercial operations in earnest, but it has completed its very first mission as an independent company, and that was done on March the 11th. So one of its belugas flew to a place called Sanford, which is near Orlando in Florida, to deliver an Airbus built Eutelsat 36D geostationary telecommunications satellite. Try saying that when you're drunk. It's actually the third time that a Beluga transport aircraft has delivered one of Airbus's satellites. And obviously it's not going to Sanford particularly, it's going to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida for launching into space. So the previous missions that the Beluga undertook included a Hotbird 13G satellite, which was back in October 22, and Inmarsat 6 -F2, which was January 23. But, you know, getting such a big aircraft, and let's face it, quite an old aircraft, across the Atlantic is no mean feat. Despite being huge in terms of cargo capacity, the belugas are very limited in range. According to the manufacturer's specifications page, the ST's maximum range is 829 nautical miles. Well, it needed to take this satellite for just around 4,500 nautical miles. So obviously it had to have a few stops along the way, and it actually had three. So the actual aircraft, which was registered GSTF, took off from Toulouse Airport in France and landed at Lages Airport in Portugal on March the 10th. Well, you might think Toulouse to Portugal isn't very far, but although this place is Portugal, it's a long way from mainland Portugal because it's on Terceira Island, which is in the Azores, kind of halfway across the Atlantic almost. It then crossed the ocean to St. John's in Canada on the following day and finally completed its journey by flying to Portsmouth and then finally to Sanford. So a four-stop hop for our beluga friend. The satellite is now in place. It's being taken to the Kennedy Space Center, where it will be taken into orbit on a SpaceX Falcon 9 launch vehicle. So as I say, this is the very first operation as Airbus Beluga Transport, this new kind of Airbus subsidiary. So I think we could see a lot more from this company in the coming months. Although the belugas do have this limited range issue, they do have such a huge cargo capacity. And since we've lost things like the AN225, I think it's maybe going to have some demand for outside shipments. What do you think, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, I can't wait to see more of what it's doing over the coming coming years, and I hope it's not just Airbus satellites.
Yeah, let's hope they get some commercial customers as well.
Yeah, well, One airline that won't be using their services, I guess, is an airline that regular listeners know holds a special place in my heart, and that is Air Astana, the Kazakh flag carrier. That was a terrible segue, I'm sorry. but last Friday, they released their 2023 financial results. And, you know, I did find them, I think they were more interesting than just, oh, here's some results that we're covering because you like the airline. So I wanted to dive a little bit into them this year. And so earlier this year, Air Astana listed on three stock exchanges, most notably the London Stock Exchange, and it's revealed another year of huge profits after carrying a record number of passengers. So the Kazakh carrier revealed an operating profit of $136 million, which shrank to $68.7 million after tax. Not bad for a smaller airline. So unlike many of the international airlines, Air Astana only suffered 1 year of losses during the COVID-19 pandemic, and it saw a loss of $93.9 million in 2020, but already by 2021 it was back to profit. Now, this is in part by capitalizing on a previously untapped market within Kazakhstan. A lot of passengers used to travel long distances on trains before the pandemic. And I've chatted to Peter Foster, who's the CEO of the Air Astana Group, many times. And he's said, you know, they thought, well, why don't we launch a low-cost carrier to compete with the trains? And actually, a lot of people swapped to the plane during COVID and haven't gone back. Summing up 2023 in one sentence, he said, Air Astana delivered another strong year of growth in 2023 with record passenger numbers and increased capacity. So let's dive into the numbers a little bit more. In 2023, Air Astana saw its revenue jump by 13.8% from $1 billion US dollars in 2022 to $1.3 billion. But unfortunately, the airline saw costs grow slightly more than revenue, so its operating profit after tax saw a decrease year over year. The profit fell from $148.7 million in 2022 to just $136 million in 2023, and the profit after tax fell from $78.4 million to $68.7 million. But this is still the second largest profit posted by the airline by a considerable margin. So if you just look at 5 years of data from CH Aviation, the airline's net profit was $5.4 million in 2018. It rose to $30 million in 2019. It then posted a $93.9 million loss in 2021 before returning to profit with a record at the time, $36.2 million profit in 2021. This then rose to the current record that was $78.4 million in 2022. So Air Astana revealed that it's seen significant growth on international routes to and from Kazakhstan in 2023, and this is despite the carrier exiting both Ukraine and Russia in 2022 as the current conflict broke out. But really, the Kazakh carrier has leveraged this capacity elsewhere with routes to Georgia, Greece, Montenegro, Thailand, Turkey, the UAE and Uzbekistan added to the network. I know Greece in particular, the airline couldn't launch Heraklion because there were no slots available at the airport. But then when all of the Russian airlines could no longer fly there, it opened up slots for them. So rather than flying a route to Russia that they can no longer do, they redirected that capacity to Heraklion. The carrier saw its international ASKs rise by 15.5%, while domestic ASKs only rose by 5.9%. So it's showing you that there's a lot more international capacity, although you've got to think it's probably because the routes are longer as well. That's why they add up a lot more. In case you're wondering, ASKs stand for available seat kilometers. So that's a measure of total capacity offered by an airline and is calculated by the number of seats offered times the length of a route. So, you know, if you had 100 seats and flew 800 kilometers, the ASKs would be 100 times 800, which is 80,000.
Good maths, Tom.
Yeah. I pre-did my maths because I knew that just wouldn't happen in the moment. But last summer, Air Astana's CEO Peter Foster compared the Pratt & Whitney engine issues to a chronic illness while speaking to me when I visited the airline's HQ. The good news is that the carrier is reporting that it's well positioned to mitigate the operational impact of remaining engine recalls. So it currently has 28 aircraft that are equipped with affected engines and 32 engine removals are scheduled. It's already had 5 replacement engines and is expecting to take another 3 throughout 2024. 2 of these are going to be leased, while the 3rd will be purchased as a spare engine by Air Astana. But I thought it's interesting. The carrier's not just like, oh, we're bang, bang, bang as quick as we can getting through them. It's actually resting some of its engines to manage the number of remaining cycles that it has, while also acquiring new aircraft and looking at additional A320ceo capacity in the meantime. But on the issue, Air Astana remarked, looking forward, the company is pleased to note that it's a very advanced stage in positive negotiations for an agreement with Pratt & Whitney that will provide compensation and other support to the company for the impact to its operations arising from the GTF-NEO engine availability issues. So it looks like everybody is happy there now.
Apart from Pratt & Whitney, who are going to have a big bill to pay at the end of all this with all these compensation claims. But you know what I want to know about Air Astana, Tom? I don't know if you can answer it. How are those baby Boeing 767s doing?
Well, there's nothing new to report there, but they are planned to be retired in the next year or two. 787s are going to start coming in, lease from ALC. The idea is that the finance leases on the 767s are expiring roughly in line with aircraft deliveries on the 78, and it doesn't really make sense for Air Astana to operate such a small subfleet of 767s. It's planning to build out the 78 in the future if it needs. So unfortunately,
well,
it's bye-bye.
Well, can't get any more 767s unless they used one. So
exactly. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's bye-bye. They're just kind of maintaining them now rather than upgrading them, especially when it comes to the cabin. Peter told me that he thought the cabins were getting a bit tired, you know. I didn't really feel that when I flew it. I thought it was still a really nice product, but can't wait to see what they've got in store for these 787s.
Definitely, definitely exciting stuff. Well, I'm not even going to attempt to segue from this to that, so I'm just going to go into it. Last week on the podcast, you might remember we spoke about an incident with a LATAM Dreamliner. If you didn't listen to last week's episode, why not? But let me catch you up.
You missed the perfect segue there, because I was just talking about the 787 Dreamliner on the Air Astana.
See, I'm no good at this segue game, Tom. You're going to have to invent a new game for me. So to catch you up, last week on March the 11th, there were reports that more than 50 passengers were injured on board a LATAM Airlines flight operating between Sydney and Auckland. So this was a Fifth Freedom flight, and LATAM was using, as Tom rightly said, its Boeing 787-9 Dreamliner. Passengers reported the plane suddenly diving towards the ground, throwing some people out of their seats. Since the incident, I've seen reports online of people saying that passengers were stuck to the ceiling, that they were hitting the roof so hard the ceiling panels got broken. I must add that the plane landed safely. We did hear from the ambulance service that more than 50 people were treated for injuries, but only one was serious. So I think everyone is okay. At the time when we reported this last week, the airline only claimed a technical malfunction. But of course, investigations have ensued. And I think we commented at the time, Tom, that it sounded like a clear air turbulence incident, but they never once mentioned turbulence. They must have known straight away it wasn't that. So there have been some bits and pieces coming out about this since the investigation began, particularly interesting from some Chilean investigators who've been focused on the movement of the pilot's seat inside the cockpit of the 787. So sources familiar with the investigation have indicated that the quick change in altitude could have been caused by the movement of one of the cockpit seats. The problem here is that the pilot's cockpit seat on the 787 is pretty difficult to get into. There's a really large centre console on one side and it kind of butts up to the cabin wall on the other side. So to make it easier for pilots, Boeing installed a switch on the back of the seat just behind the headrest, which you can press, and kind of motorised movement of the seat comes backwards to allow you to get in, and then you can move it forwards into your comfortable position. It's got a cover on it, and it should be covered over when the plane is in use. But for some reason, it doesn't seem to have happened on this particular flight. So initial investigations suggest this button was inadvertently pressed, which caused the dive. So if you imagine you're a pilot sitting in a Boeing with the yoke in front of you, the seat moves forward quite suddenly. The pilot presses into the control column, pushing forward the yoke and causing the plane to nosedive. I mean, crazy, crazy sequence of events, but we've heard weirder things in aviation, let's be fair. Some reports have even said it was a member of cabin crew who inadvertently leaned on the button as they were delivering refreshments to the crew. But, you know, we don't point fingers and name names. We need to wait for the investigation, of course. Since the incident, Boeing has issued a safety advisory to airlines requesting that they inspect the motorized cockpit seats at the next maintenance check of the aircraft. They sent a statement to Simple Flying, which read, "The investigation of flight LA-800 is ongoing and we defer to the investigation authorities on any potential findings. We have taken the precautionary measure of reminding 787 operators of a service bulletin originally issued in 2017, which included instructions for inspecting and maintaining switches on flight deck seats. We're recommending operators perform an inspection at the very next maintenance opportunity." So not an urgent airworthiness directive, which would require they check it straight away. Just, you know, next time you're looking, have a check of this thing. It also provided information on how to disable the seat motor, which I guess could suggest maybe nobody pressed it and it just kind of took off on its own. But anyway, like I say, we don't speculate, or I do, but please don't hold me to it. We will wait and see. When Boeing sent this advisory, it didn't say it was about the LATAM flight, but the FAA said it was released in response to an incident on LATAM flight 800. So I think we'll probably have to wait some months for the final incident report. But I thought it was really interesting how such a terrible, scary disaster, or not a disaster, thankfully, but almost a disaster could happen because of a seat movement. And, you know, when you start thinking about it, it just gets weirder. So we'll be interestingly following this as it goes forward.
No, I'm really happy that you explained that, because I'd heard about the seat, but I hadn't read into it. And I was kind of like, how does this all equate to the aircraft dropping? But actually, you know, what you've explained does kind of make sense. And yeah, we'll have to wait and see. But I guess it really shows why people are telling, why the crew are always telling you to keep your seatbelt fastened, even when the sign is on, off, if you're sitting down, because this could happen at any time.
Yeah, I'd like to take the opportunity to stress that point, because, you know, I think what we saw on Alaska Airlines with the MAX 9 blowout would have been so much worse if it hadn't been for the fact that plane was just taking off and all the passengers were strapped in and would have been checked to have been strapped in, you know, sort of 5-10 minutes before. So I always keep my seatbelt on a plane, because I've seen the awful things that turbulence can do very unexpectedly to poor people. So,
I mean, I just don't see the point in not wearing it, you know. But hey, I've got a really out there segue for you now.
Go for it.
You know how LATAM used to be in the One World Alliance until it wasn't? Well,
yes.
Another carrier in the One World Alliance is Qatar Airways. And they were the other big
terrible.
Sort of, I know, I'm sorry, apologies to our listeners, but not to Joe. They kind of had the other big story that I was interested in talking about this week. And that is that the new Qatar Airways CEO, Badr Mohamed Al-Mir, gave his first media interview since assuming the role of CEO from outgoing Akbar Al-Baker. So since November 2023, Al-Mir has made some changes in the airline, and it's entered a new era after this transition. In an interview with CNBC, he revealed the airline's plans are to unveil a new high-yielding first-class concept for its cabins, and it's reportedly in the final stages of development and will hopefully be announced soon. Speaking in the interview, Al-Mir said, "We wanted to combine the experience of flying commercial and flying on a private jet and develop something new. We're about 70% to 80% ready. We are only finalizing colors and small touches, but hopefully we will be able to announce it very soon." Now, I found this really interesting because it shows that Al-Mir is not necessarily following the same path as his predecessor, because last year, under the leadership of Al-Baker, Qatar Airways announced that it would eventually move away from first class on its long-haul routes because it was deemed unnecessary.
Yeah. In fact, when I spoke to Al-Baker back in, 2020, 21, we spoke about new incoming aircraft and whether they'd have a first class. And he said at the time that their business class was so good, they wouldn't need a first class, and that first class was completely off the table. So it's really interesting that they've kind of U-turned on this.
No, I remember that, but I think it's interesting, but it's also, I think, refreshing to see that there are new ideas circulating and we're not just sticking with the same old. But, you know, it's not just first class that Almir's sights are on, though. He also revealed that the airline is planning to launch a Q-Suite 2.0. So, you know, the current Q-Suite is widely regarded as one of the best business class products in the airline industry today. However, according to Head for Points, the current product is too big for some of Qatar's wide bodies, such as the Boeing 787. So what do we know about this second generation Qatar Airways Q-Suite? Well, actually not much.
It will be smaller.
Yeah, of course, it should fit on all of the airline's current and future wide bodies, but that's about all we know. But do you know what is exciting, Joe?
I don't know. What is exciting, Tom?
Almir has said that the airline will release the Q-Suite 2.0 at this year's Farnborough Airshow. So we've already got something to look forward to.
Excellent. That's only a few months away. So they must have been working on this for a while.
Yeah, I reckon that's probably something that's been worked on since the Albeca times. But we'll see.
Awesome. Oh, well, that's exciting. But I'll tell you an airline. Well, I won't tell you the airline, but somewhere that you won't get a first class seat is on a regional jet. And I never get to talk about regional jets on the podcast. I do enjoy them. I like turboprops ever so slightly more, but I do love an Embraer and particularly the E2. I think it's great. But, you know, for some people, how long is too long to spend sitting on a regional jet? How long's too long for you, Tom?
I mean, it depends, you know. I feel like it's not, because your regional jets, is it a 2x2 or a 3x3?
It's a 2x2, the E195 E2, yeah.
I feel like you could sit on a 2x2 for a bit longer, because it's not, you know, like I did a 3-hour 2x2 with Air Astana in Almaty, from Aktau to Almaty, and that was actually really pleasant, because I was sat next to somebody I knew, you know, it wasn't as cramped as a 3x3. I would say even longer than an A320, personally.
Oh, that's really good to hear, because you can go on some really long ones now. And in fact, the first operator of the E195 E2 in North America is the one that's really pushing the boundaries right now. So I must be talking, of course, about Canadian regional airline Porter. Those guys got their first E195 E2 back in December 22, and they've been gradually building the fleet and rolling out the jet on domestic and some international routes, but now it's added its longest jet. In fact, it's two longest jet, which I'm really excited to see. It's also going to be the airline's first international E2 route from Montreal, so great news for Montreal locals. It's going to be flying from Montreal to Los Angeles and to San Francisco this summer, so both the routes start in late June, and the trips cover around 2,500 miles each, making them the longest routes currently flown by the airline. So its current longest, which it only launched, I think, in January this year, is Montreal to Vancouver, which is 2,295 miles. The route to San Francisco is going to be its new longest route at 2,539 miles, and it has a block time of 6 hours and 12 minutes. So is that long enough for you on a regional jet, Tom?
I would do it. Well, I'd do anything once, you know. It can't be as bad as my recent no window seat with a carrier that I won't name.
that does happen from time to time on that carrier, and lots of other bad things too, but we won't go into that now. So Los Angeles won't be much shorter. That's 2,474 miles with a block time of 5 hours and 56 minutes. In nautical miles, which is obviously what we tend to talk about in aviation, both routes are around 2,000 nautical miles, and that is actually well within the safe range of the E195 E2 range, which is published at 2,600 nautical miles. But did you know that these new routes from Porter are not the longest in the world? Can you have a guess which carrier does the very longest Embraer E2 route?
I am trying to think of who has Embraer E2s. KLM has them, but I don't think they would be the longest. Is it going to be Azul, maybe?
Oh, almost as obscure. I think it's even slightly more obscure than Azul.
Royal Jordanian?
Airpeace. So Airpeace fly the longest E2 route in the world, and that is close to its operational maximum at 2,500 nautical miles, and that's going from Lagos to Johannesburg. That's blocked out at 6 hours and 20 minutes, and apparently it still falls under the remit to be called long haul, because if you want to call a flight long haul, it's got to be 2,600 nautical miles, so it's just under that, or 3,000 regular miles. But you know, I'd argue that 6 hours is definitely a long haul flight in terms of passenger experience. So anyway, Air Peace, as I say, is taking it close to its operational maximum, but it's advantaged by very lightly loading its aircraft. It only has 124 seats out of a maximum of 146. Of course, Nigerians do like to bring a lot of baggage, so that's a consideration. But as I've seen from some other analysis, it's unlikely that Air Peace ever sells out all 124 seats. So that really helps it to push the boundaries of the E2. But I think it's just incredible how far these little jets fly. So Porter is definitely the long haul leader, although it doesn't hold the longest route, because many of its E2 routes are in the top 10 longest in the world. And actually, the airline is ambitiously growing. I mean, I know we don't talk about Porter a lot, but I really do think it's one to watch going forward. It's not really been flying internationally in the past. It only had turboprops, etc. Now it's got these jets. It's reaching out into America, into Canada. It said it can go further as well. And in fact, just before Christmas, it topped up its original order for 50 E2s with an extra 25. So that's going to be a massive fleet of 75 E195 E2s, and potentially more as well. It's announced three new crew bases in the last few weeks in Canada. So those will be in Ottawa, Montreal and Vancouver. They're adding around 350 employees to support their expansion. Just at the beginning of this month, they started flying to Las Vegas, and they have previously said that they could be eyeing as far away as Mexico and the Caribbean. So definitely one to watch. And like I said, I'm always so impressed by how far these Embraer jets can fly. Really interesting little plane to watch, and a very interesting airline, in my opinion.
I do wonder how far you could fly if you even use one of them as a private jet with such a lower capacity, but who knows?
Yeah, it could be interesting. Well, I think that's all we've got time for on today's podcast. We hope you enjoyed it, and welcome your feedback at editorial@simpleflying.com.
For more great content, you can visit our website at simpleflying.com or find us on social media. Simply search for Simple Flying.
If you enjoyed the podcast, please do leave us a rating on your favourite podcast player. Thanks for listening.
Bye.